Tuesday, November 13th, 1990 was a colder than usual fall day in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. It was a windy, chilly 40 degrees when 78-year-old Domingo Martinez opened up his shop as usual at 513 West Gerrard Avenue around 8:45 a.m. He owned a cash business, and a few times a week he had to make runs to his bank to make deposits and withdrawals. He usually did this on Mondays, Thursdays, and Fridays, but that week, on Monday, the bank was closed for Veterans Day. So Tuesday morning, after opening up his shop so his daughter Sarah could start handling customers, he headed towards the Mellon Bank located just over a mile away to make a large withdrawal. Within 30 minutes of heading out, he would be dead. Shot in broad daylight, his body left on the road, his car and his cash gone. Martinez had a lot of money on him when he was killed. He had withdrawn $25,000 in cold hard cash. Bank teller Betty Ligon had handed him a 3-inch-high bundle in a plain brown paper bag with no writing on it, secured by rubber bands. $11,000 in $20 bills, $10,000 in $10 bills, $500 in $5 bills, $300 in $1 bills, $150 in quarters, $40 in dimes, and $10 in nickels. Now, this wasn't unusual. It was part of his banking routine that someone, one of the family members working for Martinez, would actually give the bank a call beforehand, not only to let them know just how much he needed, but also the exact denominations of the currency that they wanted as well. The teller would get the withdrawal ready, Mr. Martinez would park in front of the bank, pop in for a few minutes, get his paper bag bundle that the teller often put in a white canvas bag, and head right back out. Here's how defense attorney Jim Figorski, who has worked on the case for nearly a decade, described what happened earlier that morning.
The day that of the murder, the victim, whose name was Domingo Martinez, he had a lottery business as well, and the lottery the day before had been number 222. So the idea was they were going to need some extra money in the business because they expected many hits on that number. So his daughter sent Mr. Martinez to the bank to pick up $25,000 that day. He went and he picked it up at the Mellon Bank at 1201 Spring Garden Street, and he drove away. That was the last time anyone saw him.
So that morning, Sarah Negron, Martinez's 40-year-old daughter, had called the bank to place the order. But it was Deborah Wright, Martinez's granddaughter, who worked at a different business location a few miles away, that told him earlier that morning, around 8 a.m., that they needed such a large sum. Their second location, you see, at 9th and Erie, where Deborah worked, was the one with a lottery machine. There had been a hit on the lottery numbers, and Deborah was going to need the cash for the payout, which was exactly where Martinez was heading with the bundle of money after he left the bank. After being handed the money, Martinez was always walked to his car by the bank guard, Greg Davis. On the morning of the murder, Davis, who had been working at the bank for around 4 months, did just that. He walked Martinez to his car right outside the bank. They made small talk about football. Martinez handed him an orange he found in the trunk, and then the guard watched him put the bundle of cash in the car and drive off. Davis then sauntered over to a vending cart and he grabbed a newspaper before heading back to his post. Later that day, he'd tell police that he didn't see anyone following Martinez as he drove off. But what we know now is that Martinez's murderers had been lying in wait for him all along. Support for this podcast comes from ABC's highly anticipated new series, 10 Days in the Valley. What happens when fiction becomes all too real? Kyra Sedgwick returns to TV as Jane Sadler, a famous television writer and single mother whose life is turned upside down when her young daughter is kidnapped in the middle of the night. Just like the controversial TV cop drama she works on, everything is a mystery, everyone has a secret, and everybody close to her is a suspect. 10 Days in the Valley is a chilling, thrilling, and twisty whodunit that takes place over 10 episodes in 10 weeks. Entertainment Tonight calls it heart-stopping and pulse-pounding, and Esquire says it's the new fall show that you will be obsessed with. Also starring Erica Christensen and Malcolm Jamal Warner, don't miss it. 10 Days in the Valley premieres Sunday, October 1st at 10, 9 central on ABC. Martinez was killed a few miles away on Sedgley Avenue at a place where the road rose up into a small bridge over Allegheny Avenue.
He was about 3 miles from the bank, driving east on Sedgley Street, when a car that was following directly behind him acted as if it was going to pass him, and instead swerved around and struck the side of his car in a fake accident. He pulled over. The car that struck him pulled in front of him. Three men got out, and one of them shot him through the windshield, and then dragged him into the street. And the man who shot him jumped in his car, into the victim's car, in both cars. The victim's car being driven by the shooter, and the one that was driven by the other murderers, both drove away. That was about 9:55 a.m.
Multiple calls to 911 alerted the police to the attack on Martinez. The first caller at 9:56 a.m. was a man who reported an unconscious male on the street. A minute later, a woman called to report a man who had been, quote, hit by a car, unresponsive, on the street. Fewer than 10 seconds later, a third call to 911 reported a hit-and-run accident with a man lying at Sedgley and Allegheny at the top of the bridge. And finally, a fourth call at 9:57 a.m. reported a car accident but gave no further details. All of these calls seemed to indicate that Martinez was hit in some sort of accident, but it quickly became apparent that that wasn't the case at all. He had been murdered, right there in the middle of the street that cold November morning. And Martinez's murder didn't just take place in broad daylight, it took place with witnesses all around. Witnesses who not only saw him laying in the street and called it in, but witnesses who saw him actually getting killed. A lot of people happened to be driving along the same road. When Martinez's car was slammed to the side, it ended up blocking a line of cars behind him. Alan King was driving his wife's car that morning, a 1979 silver Cadillac, with his friend Roy Howard in the passenger seat. But as they began driving up the slight rise of Sedgley Avenue, they came to a halt. About three cars ahead of them, a gray car was haphazardly pulled over, partially blocking the road. King beeped his horn, but no one moved. Roy Howard told police he saw three males get out of a car, a red and white car, and walk back towards Martinez's car, all three of them approaching the driver's side. One of the men, over 6 feet tall with light brown skin and a red sweatsuit, was by Martinez's driver's side door. Neither King or Howard reported hearing any shots, but what likely happened here was that they had arrived in the scene after Martinez was shot. What they did both see was the man in the red pull Martinez out of his car while the other two men walk back to their red and white car and get back in. Neither King or Howard reported what the cars in front of them did, but they, for a brief moment, said they thought it looked like the old man needed help. Remember, these two witnesses didn't hear any shots, so they didn't even realize they were witnessing a murder. They pulled around and right up next to Martinez's car, and they saw that it was blocked by that red and white car, which they said was a 76 or 78 Nova or Skylark, which was pulled right in front of the victim's car. Now, King noticed the window of the victim's car had been shattered, and he saw the man in red, who was now inside the victim's car, kicking Martinez's legs out of the car so he could get the door closed. Both Howard and King spotted a gun tucked in the man's waistband, a large .45 caliber handgun, they said, and King hit the gas, realizing it wasn't safe to stop. The red and white car with the other two perps in it was directly in front of them, and both cars approached the next intersection on 6th Street. The red and white car made a right on 6th Street, and the man in the red sweatsuit, who was driving Martinez's car, was right behind King and Howard. As they stood still on that intersection, the man in Martinez's car swung around them, honked, and made a right as well. So both of the cars carrying the three perpetrators disappeared down 6th Street while King and Howard continued going straight on Sedgley, stunned and scared by what they just saw. Later that same day, they both reported that they went on to grab the car parts they needed and they were actually working on King's car when they saw a female law enforcement officer on the street and they approached her and told her what they had witnessed that morning. The officer called in the report, realizing that these two guys had witnessed the Martinez murder, and they both were interviewed that afternoon, along with a third witness who also reported the murder the same day.
My name is Ron Smith, and I believe I was the witness to the, I guess, the incident that was the person that alerted the police regarding the shooting. That particular morning, I remember that I was leaving school, and I went to my work to ask if I could take off because I had to prepare for finals. So, you know, after I, the work, you know, said that it was okay for me to go home and study, I was on my way home, and I went through the back roads of Philadelphia from work on my way to my house in Fishtown, and I came over the crest of a hill, and there was, you know, car stopped in front of me. So okay. Just not thinking anything of it, you know, I was waiting behind, you know, that one car, and then I noticed a gentleman shoot, you know, through the, into the car in front of him.
The car that Ron Smith was waiting behind was occupied by two men, Roy Howard and Alan King, the witnesses I just told you about. In Smith's 1990 statement, given a couple of weeks after the murder, he doesn't say that he saw the actual shooting, but does report seeing a, quote, big black male wearing a long red winter jacket pulling an older male out of a cream-colored Oldsmobile. And while that interview took place 15 days after the murder, Smith actually contacted the police immediately after he witnessed it, as soon as he realized someone had been shot.
So upon seeing that, I just shrunk down in my seat and just floored it, you know, past the scene. And I came to a police officer who was in the middle of Erie Avenue, in the middle of the street, just, I guess, monitoring traffic. And I alerted the police officer. I told him what had happened, and he took, you know, he wrote it down, and then he left. And then that's basically, I didn't hear anything for a while.
It took a couple of weeks for the police to get in touch with Smith again and take his statement.
I do remember that there was two officers. They came. We went into the lunchroom of the company that I was working for. They asked for my recollection, description, and they had a book of, I guess, mugshots to look through.
Okay. Were you able to identify anybody?
I wasn't. I just gave my description of, you know, what my events were, what the person was wearing, what they looked like. I don't remember it now, but I did at that time. And that was it. You know, they took that information and I don't remember if I heard anything for a while. I remember being told, because I think I called to follow up to see if there was anything else needed, and I was told that no, I wouldn't be needed anymore because my testimony didn't match other people's testimony.
Unfortunately for a lot of people, Ron Smith wasn't contacted again for many, many years. The morning after the murder, the Philadelphia Inquirer featured a story about the crime. An excerpt read, Martinez's body was on the ground when the police arrived, his hat and glasses nearby. Police recovered his wallet and about $400 on his body. He was pronounced dead at 10:22 a.m. at Temple University Hospital. His car was recovered about 3 hours after the shooting at 2nd and Diamond Streets, about 16 blocks from the shooting. Community leaders were stunned yesterday by the news of Martinez's death. Here's criminal defense attorney Jim Figorski again. Tell us a little bit about who Martinez was and what he did.
The victim owned a business, and they called the business a check cashing and travel agency, but it was later identified in the press as some kind of a community bank. which was a bank for people who couldn't go to a bank. Mm-hmm. And they took deposits, and they gave people bank books, and people would, or they would write in the amount that they deposited.
Esther's travel agency, named after Martinez's wife, had three locations in Philadelphia and one in New Jersey. Martinez had done well. He was a successful local businessman who was also deeply involved in the community. An article in the Philly Inquirer reported the following. Community leaders were stunned yesterday by the news of Martinez's death. Domingo is a legend in our community, said Candelero Lamboy, president of the Council of Spanish-Speaking Organizations, a group that Martinez helped form 20 years ago. It is sad. When I heard what happened to him, it was shocking. It was really like something hit me hard. Martinez was also a founding member in 1968 of Aspera Incorporated of Pennsylvania, a nonprofit group aimed at promoting education among Puerto Rican youth. He was also heavily involved in Democratic politics during the 1960s and 1970s and worked on mayoral campaigns for Frank L. Rizzo. He was a man that I respected, Rizzo said. He added that Martinez had, in previous conversations, expressed his desire to help Hispanics in Philadelphia, quote, make their lives just a little bit better, and he was working towards that goal. Martinez came to the area in the late 1940s from Puerto Rico to work at Campbell Soup Company, said Lamboy, who had known him since 1952. He later became one of the first Hispanic business owners in the city when he opened a grocery at Fairmont Avenue and Marshall Street. He also operated a warehouse from which he was the first in the area to distribute tropical foods in the 1950s, according to Emmanuel Ortiz, who used to trade in his soda pop bottles for change at his store. Martinez distributed products new to the area, such as Café Bustelo, a popular Puerto Rican coffee, remembered Ortiz, whose family has known Martinez for almost 40 years. Martinez also owned Esther's Travel Agency, which has two locations in the city and is now run by his daughter. He also owned a travel agency in Puerto Rico, Ortiz said. Martinez graduated from LaSalle College in 1968 with a bachelor's degree in accounting and became the first Latino-certified public accountant in the state, Ortiz said. Another article ran this blurb. A prominent leader in the early growth of Philadelphia's Puerto Rican community was killed yesterday when three men in a Chevy Nova, apparently feigning an accident, sideswiped his car, robbed him, shot him in the chest, and stole his automobile. Police described the incident, which occurred on Sedgley Avenue in North Philadelphia, as, quote, a bump and rob. Police said that Domingo Martinez, 78, of the 500 block of West Girard Avenue, might have been followed after making a withdrawal of more than $10,000 from a Mellon Bank branch at 12th and Spring Garden Streets for his two travel agencies in the city, according to a source familiar with the investigation. He normally made such withdrawals on Mondays, but could not do so this Monday because of the Veterans Day holiday, police said. Martinez was driving east about 10 a.m. on Sedgley Avenue in his gray 1987 Oldsmobile Cutlass when a car with three males sideswiped him and forced him to the curb near a bridge between 7th and 9th Streets, police said. Martinez was pronounced dead at the hospital at 10:22 a.m. The autopsy showed Martinez died from a single shot to the chest. The gunshot laceration was located on the left side of his body, 3 inches from the midline of his chest, 9 inches below the shoulder. The bullet pierced his lung and then the left ventricle and the left atrium of the heart, stopping only when it got to the soft tissue of his back. The medical examiner reported recovering a, quote, nicely mushroomed lead bullet from the victim, which was washed, dried, and placed in an envelope.
Stamps.com brings all the services the U.S. Postal Service right to your fingertips. You can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter, any package, any class of mail using just your own computer and printer. Stamps.com makes it easy. They'll send you a digital scale that automatically calculates exact postage. Stamps.com will even help you decide the best class of mail based on your individual needs. You can create your Stamps.com account in minutes online with no equipment to lease and no long-term commitments. You just click, print, mail, and you're done. And unlike the post office, Stamps.com never closes. You can print postage for letters or packages at your convenience 24/7. Now, as you're going to see, the Undisclosed team is working on several different cases in several different states, and I'm also working on several friend of the court briefs in different states. And let me tell you, Stamps.com makes it so easy to send and receive documents in those cases. And right now, you too can enjoy the Stamps.com service with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus postage and a digital scale, all without any long-term commitments. Just go to stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in undisclosed. That's stamps.com, enter undisclosed. Stamps.com, never go to the post office again.
As Susan adeptly demonstrated in her series on Gary Mitchum, it does matter who the victim of a crime is. While there's no such thing as an ordinary murder, some victims do get more attention from the police than others, and in this case, given his prominence, Martinez's community and family must have given the police a lot of pressure to make an arrest. So the cops set out to do just that. Luckily, they had a good lead right off the bat. At 10:09 a.m., not long after Martinez was shot and the police arrived at the scene, a flash alert was sent out to other officers. A police officer on the scene reported the following to a dispatch officer. Quote, "Look, I got some information on this job from 7th and Sedgley. We're looking for a four-door gray Nova. It's occupied by two black males wearing red hoods, one black male wearing a black jacket." The police dispatcher then sent out this flash alert. "All cars stand by unless you have a priority. All cars stand by in the 25. Flash information on a founded shooting at Sedgley and Allegheny. Be on the lookout for a beat-up four-door gray Nova occupied by two black males. They're both wearing white, red hoods. One's wearing a black jacket. They were last seen on Sedgley with that. From that location within the last 15 minutes. Tag unknown at this time." That's repeating. "Flash information on a founded shooting at Sedgley and Allegheny. Be on the lookout for a beat-up four-door gray Nova occupied by two black males. Both of them are wearing red hoods. One's wearing a black jacket. It last seen on Sedgley from that location within the last 15 minutes. Tag unknown at this time." About 10 minutes later, as they were still trying to figure out who the victim was, the officer realized Martinez's car was missing. He said to dispatch, "If they can find an owner's card on the vehicle for him, his vehicle may have been taken in this mess." At the hospital, after being pronounced dead, Martinez had been identified and his relatives were informed. His daughter Sarah and granddaughter told the police that he had been driving a 1987 two-door gray Oldsmobile with a Lions Club sticker. Martinez's car was found later that same afternoon, recovered not far from the crime scene, parked on the street. The bag of cash was missing from the car's trunk. But back to that flash report. Remember two of the witnesses we already mentioned, Roy Howard and Alan King, who reported seeing the perpetrators with a red and white car? Well, where did the police get information that they needed to be on the lookout for a gray Nova?
Well, the police first spoke to a woman who saw the murder from about a block away. And she actually heard the accident. She didn't see it. And she looked up from her doorway where she was onto a hill where the murder happened. And she said she saw two gray cars. And she said three men got out of one of the cars and ran back to the victim. And she heard a gunshot. She didn't see anybody shot. She didn't see anybody with a gun. She was too far away. And then she saw everybody scatter. And the three men, or, you know, two of the three men jumped back into one car. One man jumped into the victim's car, and all the cars took off. So the flash information went over that there was a gray Chevy Nova that were driven by three African-American men. That's what they were looking for on the day of the murder.
The witness was a 17-year-old named Carmen Garcia. Garcia was visiting her aunt that morning, and her aunt lived in a row home just at the far end of the crest of Sedgley, where Martinez had been killed. She was looking out the front door of her aunt's home when she heard a loud bang, which she said sounded like two cars running into each other. Her police statement read, "I heard a bang, like two cars had banged into each other. I looked up to Sedgley Street and I saw two cars. Both of the cars were gray. The one was a Premier gray Nova. The other was a shiny gray. It was a long car. It looked new, I think. It was a two-door. It looked like the Nova had pulled up onto the driver's side of the newer car and they hit. After they both stopped, three black guys jumped out of the Nova and ran towards the other car. Then I heard a bang. There was only one. It sounded like a gunshot, but I didn't see any of them with a gun. They were too far from me. Just after I heard the gunshot, two of the black guys ran back to the Nova, and the other black guy got into the driver's side of the newer car, and they both drove off. The Nova was in front. they drove over Sedgley toward Marshall Street. Now, it would seem to a novice that with a slew of eyewitnesses to both the crime and the getaway in a heavily policed area, it wouldn't be too difficult to catch the culprits. But for the next 2 months, the police were not able to make an arrest. I would love to tell you what was happening in the investigation during that time, but there's a big gaping hole in the case records where there should be notes detailing what steps the police were taking in the days and weeks after the murder. See, in a typical case file, daily activity sheets, which are prepared on a computer and filed daily so the supervisor can see what they're doing on the case, would tell us what the police were doing day to day. But like other cases we've covered on this podcast, well, the state hasn't made it easy to get all the information we need to put together a complete picture. And Pennsylvania has extraordinarily difficult rules when it comes to access to case files. Basically, and we'll get into this in a later episode, defense counsel can't just pick up a phone and get the police investigative or homicide file. They have to fight hard during trials to get access to it, and they're lucky when they do. And another thing, those files cannot be requested through a public records request either. Yeah, you heard that right. Even years after a case has been closed, they cannot be requested by the public. So we don't really know what happened in the weeks right after Martinez was murdered. But fast forward a few months, and suddenly it seems like there's a break in the case. An informant living in the nearby Abbotsford Homes housing project stepped up to tell her handler that she knew something.
There was an informant in Abbotsford Homes who was a woman who knew the police officers. I'm not sure if she was an actual documented informant, but she knew the police and she was in the past had fed them information before.
How do you know that?
She told me. She spoke to her about 3 years ago. And she said that all the information she gave the police were rumors that she heard. She had no firsthand knowledge of anything. But there was a rumor in the project that certain people from Abbotsford Homes had done this murder.
This informant told the police she heard the Stallworths and the Thompson brothers were involved in the crime. The Stallworths she was referring to were three men, two of whom, John and William, were brothers. The third was John and William's cousin, Nathaniel Stallworth. And whether the informant actually met Thompson or was confused, we aren't sure, but the Stallworths led the police to two brothers named Mustafa and Sean Thomas, not Thompson. It took 3 years to investigate the crime and piece together the evidence, but by the time the charges were brought against all five defendants, it was, to the naked eye, an open and shut case. The brothers Stallworths, John and William, had confessed to murdering Domingo Martinez, and they said they weren't in it alone. Mustafa and Sean had planned it with them. Here is the narrative as laid out in the arrest warrant of Sean Thomas, who was 16 at the time the murder took place and 19 at the time that he was arrested for it in 1993. On 10/27/1992, John Stallworth, black male, was questioned inside the homicide division by the affiant about the 11/13/90 murder of Mr. Martinez. He made a statement that he, along with several others, had left from the Abbotsford projects approximately 9 a.m. in two cars and had driven to the bank at Ridge and Spring Garden with the intent of watching the bank looking for the victim. After they arrived there, they spotted an older victim who had put money in his trunk outside the bank and drove off. They all followed behind the victim inside their cars. They drove for some time when his one co-conspirator, who he identifies as Mustafa Clayton Thomas, who was driving the car that Stallworth was in, said, "Showtime," and then speeded up and hit the victim's car on the driver's side. When the victim stopped, their second car blocked him off, and then Mustafa got out and approached the driver's side of the victim's auto and shot the victim right through the windshield. Mustafa then took the victim's car and they followed him. After several minutes, Mustafa parked the victim's car and brought the money to them and they drove off. Stallworth further stated that all the conspirators received part of the stolen money, which he had heard on the news was $25,000. He identified Mustafa Clayton Thomas as a person who shot Mr. Martinez and Mustafa's brother Sean Thomas and his own brother William Sean Stallworth as participants in this robbery murder. In their opening statement at trial, here's what the prosecution said happened. Quote, "You will hear testimony that back on the day before, the night before, which will be Monday, November the 12th of 1990, somewhere in the Abbotsford's home that John Stallworth and his brother, William Stallworth, Sean Thomas, and Mustafa Thomas and others decided that they would pull a robbery the next morning. A random robbery, a place to be selected, apparently when you hear the evidence, was on the spur of the moment. You will hear testimony that the next morning, which will be Tuesday, November 13th of 1990, the day of the incident itself, that they met there in the morning and they left in two separate cars, a gray car and a blue car, to scout out a place in which they would commit a robbery. You will hear from the stalwarts, particularly John Stalwart, that he had done this before and the routine would be that they would come and wait outside the financial institution or bank, and that one of the parties would go inside and see who was getting the money from a particular teller. If it looks like a large sum of money, and the person who went into, in other words, scope out the place, will come out and tell the others who the person was who got the money inside. He will tell you, if the person came out and walked on the street, it would be John Stalwart's job to run up behind him, hit him on his head, jump in the car, and flee. And from his testimony and from his appearance, you will get the impression that he has, in fact, done this before. Now, I indicated they met there that morning in the Abbotsford Projects and left in two different cars to pick a particular financial bank, in fact, to pull off some sort of robbery. The prosecutor goes on to say later in his opening statement about Martinez, quote, he was given the money in a regular bank bag, which was put inside of a canvas bag, and that while this money was being handed over to the counter to him, a friend, and that is the only name we know him as, a friend of Mustafa Thomas, the second defendant over there, was in the bank and saw this transaction. He came back out and told the others, Poppy got the money, meaning the old man got the money. The plan was that the old man would be bumped from the rear by the blue car directly behind him, and the other car, the gray car, would go around and cut the old man around in the front. You'll hear testimony from John Stalwart that his job would be to jump out, take the keys, get the money from the trunk from the old man and leave. Nothing about shooting anybody or killing anybody. John Stalwart will testify he laid down in the back seat of the car, and as they drove around after the defendant, Mustafa said it was taking too long. All of a sudden, he heard a bump as the rear car hit the back of Mr. Domingo Martinez's car. Mr. Martinez's car came to a stop. You will hear at this time members of the blue car in the rear with Mustafa driving, Mustafa's friend from the front passenger seat, and John Stalwart in the back. All three of these males got out of the blue car. None of the three males got out of the car in the front, and John Stalwart will testify it was his opinion that he was going to go over and take the keys from the old man and get the money from the trunk, and they would be on their way. But after the car came to a stop after bumping the old man, he will testify Mustafa said, quote, it is showtime, and they got out of the car and walked over there. He never saw a gun on Mustafa at that point. He will testify Mustafa say, quote, I got this, meaning he will do this. You will hear testimony Mustafa went up to the car with the old man sitting in the driver's seat, that he pulled from his waist a 9mm handgun and shot Mr. Domingo Martinez once in his chest, which penetrated his left chest and went through his heart, causing his death. And at that point, you will hear testimony from John Stalwart that the car with his brother, Sean, and Nasir, up front, took off at a high rate of speed. If you're wondering right now who Nasir is, well, Nasir is one more co-conspirator named by the Stalwarts to the police as being implicated in this crime. Now, remember the witnesses we talked about earlier. All of them reported seeing three men, but by the time this case came to trial, it had turned into six defendants. All right, getting back to that opening statement, the prosecutor goes on to say, you'll hear testimony that they later met up around the corner, not the first car with Sean, the other two, that took off and was gone. You will hear John Stalwart testify he went around the corner, at which point the defendant, Mustafa, who was alone in the deceased's car, then drove up and joined John Stalwart and the friend of Mustafa, and they drove to the project somewhere in South Philadelphia with the money. You will hear testimony that sometime later that night, after it had gotten dark, that those with the money, that is, Mustafa, John Stalwart, and Mustafa's friend, then drove with the money to the Abbotsford projects where the money was supposed to have been split up evenly. Towards the end of his opening argument, the prosecutor says, you will hear testimony that Homicide had John Stalwart delivered from the feds down at the federal building to Homicide at 8th and Ray Streets. They brought him in. They gave him his constitutional warnings, and he then made a statement, a confession, if you will, to the Homicide detectives, Detectives Martin Devlin and Paul Worrell, where he told of this particular incident of Tuesday, November 13th of 1990, and in fact, in his statement to them, identified the others involved, including his own brother, William, Sean Thomas, Mustafa Thomas, some guy named Nasir, and a friend of Mustafa, which was the only name they knew, the friend of Mustafa. You will hear, as I told you at the very outset of my comments, that the Stalwarts, John and his brother, William, have pled guilty to this case to murder in the third degree. They plead guilty to robbery, and they plead guilty to criminal conspiracy. Thank you. Now, when you have not one but two defendants, brothers at that, confess to a crime and corroborate each other as to who was involved, it seems pretty seamless. But while the stalwart brothers came clean, the Thomases, Mustafa and Sean, claimed their innocence. And they have maintained that innocence for the past 24 years. And Sean didn't just maintain his innocence, he fought long and hard to prove it, reaching out to everyone imaginable to try and get help over these many years. And he had good reason to, because he had an alibi. And not just any alibi. Sean Thomas's alibi for the time that Domingo Martinez was murdered was the state of Pennsylvania itself.
I found out during the trial, I kept telling Canusa, I said, yo, you got to get the J file to show that I was at court that day. I didn't know, exactly know what was in there. I just knew we had a file that you should, I said, you got to present the alibi defense for me. My alibi defense was that I was at the 9th District that night. So there's no way I could have been at a homicide scene. They said 10 o'clock.
Next time on Undisclosed. A very big thank you to everyone who has made this show and this series possible, starting with the Pennsylvania Innocence Project. Thank you guys for everything you do and for working with us on this case. Thank you to our amazing producer, Mithil Thelhan, for keeping it all together. Thank you to Baluki for our original and this new logo. Thanks to our fantastic sponsors who make it possible for us to come back week after week with new episodes for you guys. Thanks to all of you listeners for your continued support. Lots of gratitude to audio producer extraordinaire Rebecca Lavoy of Partners in Crime Media and also the host of the fantastic podcast Crime Writers On. Please do follow us on social media. You'll find us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. The handle is @UndisclosedPod. And don't forget to tweet your questions at us. Every week, John Cryer will be back to host our addendum. Very excited about that. Thank you to John for doing that again for us. But make sure you use the hashtag UDAddendum so we can find your questions. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode of Undisclosed.